Chapter 4. Grief, Fear, and Lies. The plague was nothing. Fear of the plague was much more formidable. Henri Poincaré, French Geodesy, 1900. Wanda DeCell, a 76-year-old nurse from Madera, California, had no family members by her side when she died of coronavirus on March 30, 2020. Her daughter, Marina Silva, had said goodbye to her via FaceTime a few days earlier, asking her to blink if she could hear. DeCell had contracted the virus 3 weeks before when she attended a funeral of a young colleague in the medical practice where she had worked for 40 years. At least 14 others contracted the disease from that same funeral in a super-spreading event. DeCell subsequently transmitted the virus to her daughter, who fell ill caring for her, and who then passed it along to her own daughter. Both the daughter and the granddaughter recovered in time to attend DeCell's funeral. But it was a funeral few could have imagined only a few weeks before, a drive-by burial during which the grieving family and a handful of friends sat in their separate cars at an 80-foot distance from the casket, which was lowered into the ground by four funeral home staff in masks and white gloves. The members of the close-knit, ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, are deeply immersed in shared daily rituals and face-to-face interactions, so the high mortality rate from COVID-19 and the physical distancing it imposed was a particularly harsh blow. One rabbi organized a special hotline to play ancient Jewish prayers for the dying on a speakerphone placed next to isolated ICU patients' bedsides. "My fellow Jew," a voice said reassuringly, "your family very much wants to be with you in person. However, due to the current circumstances, it just isn't safe or allowed." And then the rabbi recited Psalm 91:10. "No harm will befall you, nor will a plague fall upon your tent, for he will command his angels on your behalf to guard you in all your ways." The Talmud calls this passage the Song of Plagues. One interpretation states that Moses himself composed it while ascending into a cloud hovering over Mount Sinai, reciting these words as protection from the angels of destruction. It is hard for me to describe how hard my fellow hospice doctors and I would work, when I was still seeing patients, to keep people from dying alone. We took pains to arrange for families to have a warning about impending death, so that they could be there when the patient died, for their sake and the patient's sake. We honed our prognostic skills to help with this objective, which we regarded as essential. In fact, I wrote 2 books about prognosis because it is so central to ensuring patients a good death. If patients had to die without their loved ones, we doctors often sat at the bedsides ourselves and held their hands. I did this many times, watching the particular kind of waxing and waning breathing pattern patients often showed near the end of life, known as Cheyne-Stokes respiration, and dreading the awful soft sound of the death rattle that sometimes happened as the patient finally stopped breathing. I had the sense, more than once, that the patient's hand had gotten strangely softer just before he or she died. I cannot explain it. Maybe it marked a surrender. On other occasions, we hospice doctors would engineer intricate ways to get patients discharged from the hospital, circumventing bureaucratic obstacles and figuring out how to administer medications in non-intravenous ways so that the patients might die at home among their loved ones. And so, given the norms I had internalized, the many accounts I read of families prohibited from visiting their loved ones during the early days of COVID-19 in order to reduce the spread of infection or to conserve personal protective equipment, struck me as not just inhumane, but immoral. But as with every other serious epidemic, many people died alone in 2020. Families were deprived of the chance to say goodbye or properly grieve. In one study I had done with some colleagues published in 2000, we documented that 81% of patients and 95% of family members felt that the presence of family when the patient died was very important. The lower percentage among patients may reflect their concerns for burdening their families. but the U.S. healthcare system was unable to honor these desires during the pandemic. As a physician, I hated having to call a family to say that their loved one had died. I remember one call in particular that I had to make when I was a resident physician at the University of Pennsylvania in 1990. My patient's spouse simply could not understand what I was calling to say. It was as if my words were in a foreign language. During the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic in New York City, another doctor explained how he had tried to comfort the husband of a dead patient over the phone. He was having a really hard time. He was an older man, he was at home alone, and he didn't have any family with him. The doctor said that the encounter reminded him of prior experiences in Africa. "This happened with Ebola. The family is kept away. There are no funerals. This feels like that." Serious pandemics are a time of grief. When the death rate of a plague is particularly high, the situation is devastating. Here is an account by Petrarch of the Black Death. "What are we to do now, brother? Now that we have lost almost everything and found no rest, when can we expect it? Where shall we look for it? Time, as they say, has slipped through our fingers. Our former hopes are buried with our friends. The year 1348 left us lonely and bereft, for it took from us wealth that could not be restored by the Indian, Caspian, or Carpathian Sea. Last losses are beyond recovery, and death's wound beyond cure." Thankfully, COVID-19 is not remotely as bad as the bubonic plague. But deadly epidemics always spawn parallel epidemics of a psychological or existential nature, less tangible but equally virulent. Grief, anger, fear, denial, despair, and even anomie are not unexpected emotional reactions to the personal and collective loss in a serious outbreak of infectious disease. It can sometimes be hard to get a deep feeling for this suffering, either because people living through a pandemic are hunkered down trying to avoid their own calamities, or because of the sheer scale of the losses. The old saying about the indifference that can arise in the face of mass mortality comes to mind. One death is a tragedy, a million deaths a statistic, a variant of which is usually attributed to Stalin. Author Laura Spinney, in her account of the 1918 flu pandemic, described the many millions of deaths that occurred from influenza, amplified by the massive casualties and dislocations of World War I, as the dark matter of the universe, so intimate and familiar as not to be spoken about. 100 years later, Americans have less experience with untimely death, and they are also less resigned to it. Many people live for decades without seeing death up close. While most Americans died at home a century ago, witnessed by all their loved ones, this is less common now. But even so, there seemed to me to be an unsettling acquiescence to the COVID-19 deaths of 2020. When the death count reached 100,000, coincidentally on Memorial Day, there was a brief spasm of collective mourning. On May 24, 2020, the front page of the New York Times consisted entirely of names of the dead. But the news of the milestone was fairly quickly eclipsed by political scandals and dramatic protests. "Many people did not really have a picture of the disease or of the process of dying from it. Was it painful, undignified, lonely?" Of course, grief is not felt only for the lives lost, but also for the loss of our way of living. Adults lost their jobs or even their careers. People who were unable to pay their mortgages lost their homes. Scientists I know who had invested years in building scientific apparatuses had to abandon their research. Children were denied schooling, friendship, and outdoor play. Countless weddings and vacations were canceled, some permanently. Entrepreneurs lost their businesses. Online religious services, classes, counseling sessions, and Alcoholics Anonymous meetings were all pale replacements for the authentic connections humans evolved to crave but had to give up. In the new reality imposed by the pandemic, nearly everyone experienced some deprivation. Sometimes the losses were indeed permanent or serious: lost lives, relationships, careers, or businesses. But even comparatively minor losses felt distressing, and they were widespread. We were not supposed to shake the hands of our neighbors or see them for dinner. We could not go out to restaurants, bars, coffee houses, nightclubs, salons, or gyms in the same way, if at all. Even small everyday occurrences could remind people of loss. I'm not a clothes horse, but after just 3 months of lockdown, of wearing a t-shirt and jeans every single day, I would look into my closet, see my suits, and miss wearing them. I often complain that I have to do too much professional traveling, but one day in May, I spotted my luggage in the closet and had a wistful feeling. The damaging psychological impact of plague has been appreciated for a long time. In the 5th century BCE, regarding a plague in Athens of unknown etiology, possibilities range from typhus to Ebola, Greek general and historian Thucydides observed, "By far the most terrible feature in the malady was the dejection which ensued when anyone felt himself sickening, for the despair into which they instantly fell took away their power of resistance, and left them a much easier prey to the disorder, besides which was the awful spectacle of men dying like sheep through having caught the infection in nursing each other." The Roman emperor and philosopher Marcus Aurelius noted in the 2nd century that what he called the corruption of the mind was much more dangerous during an epidemic than any such miasma and vitiation of the air which we breathe around us. In April 2020, one national survey conducted to gauge emotional wellness revealed areas of significant distress for a sizable percentage of the population. Comparing the responses to 2019 polling data, people felt worse on several axes in 2020. The percentage of people reporting feelings of enjoyment was 64%, compared to 83% in 2019. Worry, 52% versus 35%. Sadness, 32% versus 23%. And anger, 24% versus 15%, were all higher. Significant percentages of people in 2020 also reported boredom, 44%, and loneliness, 25%. People were worried about both the disease and its effects. For instance, another survey conducted at the end of April 2020 reported that 67% of Americans were somewhat concerned or very concerned about getting coronavirus themselves. But Americans were even more concerned that their family members would get the virus, with 79% expressing this fear. Another, more clinically focused study found that whereas in 2018, 3.9% of Americans had severe psychological distress, in April 2020, 13.6% did, placing them at serious risk for longer-term psychiatric problems. Americans' feelings during the pandemic differed according to variables such as household income and gender. Adults with annual household income of less than $36,000 were less likely to feel happy, 56%, and more likely to feel worried, 58%, bored, 49%, and lonely, 38%, compared to those earning more than $90,000, 75%, 48%, 39%, and 19%, respectively. Women reported feeling about as happy as men, 71% versus 73%, but they were more worried, 51% versus 44%, and more lonely, 27% versus 20%. Over time, in another survey conducted after mitigation efforts to flatten the disease curve were well underway, Americans became slightly less fearful of contracting the coronavirus. 57% were worried in April, compared to 51% in May, but they became slightly more concerned about severe financial hardship, 48% in April, compared with 53% in May. Despite these anxieties, however, Americans generally understood that the virus had to be controlled before things could return to the way they had been. Overall, at least 2/3 of Americans rated as very important the following conditions for resuming normal everyday activities at that time. 1. Mandatory quarantine for anyone testing positive for coronavirus. 2. improved medical therapies to prevent or treat COVID-19, and 3, significant reduction in the number of new cases or deaths. In addition to grief, epidemics also bring fear. Fear can itself be contagious, forming a kind of parallel epidemic. Contagions of germs, emotions, and behaviors can act independently, or they can intersect. And fear has an advantage over even the most contagious pathogens. People can contract a disease only through contact with other infected individuals. But they can contract fear through contact with either infected individuals or fearful ones. We respond to the fear brought on by epidemics in various ways, many of which are directed at asserting control over the threat. For example, people have a tendency to blame others for the disease, which makes them feel they have some influence over the force that is affecting them. It is more soothing to feel that there is a human agent responsible for the problem, because this means human effort might be effective in response. It's more frightening to imagine that the plague originates from a vengeful, implacable God or from an uncaring and remorseless natural world. This desire for a sense of control can be destructive, especially since the objects of people's blame are often minority groups or those seen as outsiders. To mitigate this, an important challenge for public health authorities and leaders during a pandemic is to acknowledge widespread negative emotions and feelings of powerlessness and to help people effectively respond to them in constructive ways by offering outlets for their emotions. This is one of the reasons it makes sense for public health authorities to encourage the use of masks, and it's also why people can find mask wearing beneficial. It gives them something concrete to do in the face of the threat, regardless of the exact benefits of masks, which are considerable. This helps restore their sense of control. Another example is the act of collective public cheering for healthcare workers seen in New York City and London, which also gives people a sense of control and social solidarity. This psychological benefit is important in itself, and such acts may in turn foster a willingness to engage in more burdensome, difficult, and challenging practices. Getting fear and anxiety under control is critical. But it is easier said than done. Sometimes the lengths people go to displace fear, restore a sense of control, and assign blame can be quite baroque. During the 1916 outbreak of polio in the United States, the public faced a conundrum. The virus disproportionately struck young children in suburbs and more sparsely populated rural areas. How could this be squared with deeply entrenched stereotypes about urban immigrant tenement dwellers as vectors of disease? A New Jersey newspaper made a conceptual leap when it published a drawing of a giant horsefly seen menacing a helpless baby with this caption: "I am the baby killer. I come from garbage cans uncovered, from gutter pools and filth of streets, from stables and backyards neglected, slovenly homes, all manner of unclean places. I love to crawl on baby's bottles and baby lips. I love to wipe my poison feet on open food, in stores and markets patronized by fools." Creating an imaginary vector connected the sickness of innocent children to groups deemed worthy of blame, while also suggesting a way to avoid risk and restore a sense of control. A germ cannot be seen, but a fly can, and the actions required to deal with flies were positive and helped people feel more in control, use screens and swatters. The fly theory also helped to explain how the sickness could have appeared in clean suburban homes. The danger was transported from a risk source composed of outsiders. In reality, of course, polio primarily spreads by the ingestion of fecal material from an infected person, for instance, through contaminated water or food. As Anne Finger explains in her moving autobiographical and cultural history of the polio virus, the fly became a carrier not just of contagion, but of displaced emotions. Fear brought on by epidemics can even cause people to shun those trying to help control the disease. On March 30, 2020, emergency physician Richard Levitin reported for duty at New York's Bellevue Hospital. The New Hampshire resident, like other volunteers from around the country who answered Governor Andrew Cuomo's call, had rushed to relieve the overwhelmed ICU staff in the city's hospitals. Dr. Levitin had trained at Bellevue himself and was an expert in intubation, the thorny task of placing and managing the endotracheal tube in critically ill patients undergoing mechanical ventilation. "This pandemic is the airway challenge of the century," he said. "I'm an airway guy. I'm not going to sit this one out." Dr. Levitin was planning to stay in his brother's empty apartment, but he soon faced a vexing obstacle, one of New York's notoriously unwelcoming co-op boards, which refused him temporary residence on the basis that he would be working with infected patients. He noted that the building was a ghost town, and some portion of those remaining were likely already infected, whereas he had come to New York from a low-prevalence state. But it did not make a difference. Other stories emerged of travel nurses, who do temporary stints in hospitals for a few weeks or months at a time, being evicted on short notice by landlords, sometimes with hostility and threats that their belongings would be thrown away. As a nurse in Hawaii cogently pointed out, however, "We are the same people who are going to take care of you if you wind up in the hospital, and if I'm sleeping in my car, I'm not functioning my best." Doctors and nurses are trained to maintain safety precautions for themselves and others, and they take extraordinary measures to keep others safe, both inside hospital walls and beyond. In fact, as Dr. Atul Gawande observed, in the face of enormous risk, American hospitals have learned how to avoid becoming sites of spread. Out of a hospital staff of 75,000 in his Boston health system, there were so few workplace transmissions in the spring of 2020 that he argued hospitals should be providing a model of how to successfully reopen other sectors of the economy. But this did not stop a Florida judge from ordering temporary full-time custody of a 4-year-old to the ex-husband of an emergency medicine doctor, despite the doctor's argument that she was doing her utmost to keep her daughter safe and that, if she were still married, no one would have removed her child from her home. We clearly do not want healthcare workers sleeping in cars or losing their children, but people can act counterproductively from both an individual and collective point of view when in the grip of strong emotions. It is hard not to see these examples as anything but a product of an atmosphere of fear generated by an epidemic disease. Yet fearful people can also play a positive role if their fear paralyzes them to the point that they self-isolate indoors or put on a mask or take other actions helpful to themselves and the broader society. Such a response will, in general, reduce the impact of the epidemic by reducing the number of people in circulation. Frightened people are not exactly eager to mingle at the neighborhood bar. However, this benefit can be fickle. A premature recovery from fear may result in reintroducing previously fearful individuals into the population at an inopportune time, such as when an outbreak has not been sufficiently controlled, thus contributing to subsequent waves of the epidemic. To further complicate matters, if the fear results in individuals fleeing, which, as we have seen, is a common response to outbreaks, then this can add to the overall intensity of the epidemic, providing new seeds for outbreaks in previously unaffected areas. And fear that results in stigmatization or scapegoating, or that increases anxiety to the point where people cannot take in useful information, can also worsen the impact of the epidemic. An extraordinary example of the harm caused by an epidemic of fear occurred in India in 1994 with an outbreak of bubonic plague. Bubonic plague has been mostly conquered in India in the modern era, although it formed part of a deadly trinity of infections, along with cholera and smallpox, for much of India's history. Starting in early August 1994, after a typical sequence of increasing fleas and the observation of rat falls, a few cases of bubonic plague were diagnosed in the village of Mamla in the B district of the Maharashtra state. On September 14th, the government of India publicly announced that Bead was affected by plague. Within hours of this announcement, there was widespread panic. And on September 23, 1994, reports of pneumonic plague, the even deadlier variant, suddenly appeared in the industrial town of Surat in neighboring Gujarat state. Between September 21st and October 20th, 1,027 patients with serious pneumonia were admitted to hospitals in that city, and 146 of the cases were for some reason presumed to be pneumonic plague. Investigators were skeptical, however, because no cases of the bubonic plague or of outbreaks in the rat population had been noted in Gujarat, both of which typically precede pneumonic plague. There were quite a few other epidemiological features that also made the diagnosis suspect. For example, almost no community transmission was documented. Individuals would become sick, but their family members would not. The cases were not clustered geographically within the city. They were spread out. A further curious observation in the Surat outbreak was that most of the initial cases were in young men in the diamond-cutting industry. And primary pneumonic plague is extremely rare. It is typically seen in people handling infected animals. Despite reasons for skepticism, the panic response was extraordinary. Massive spraying of DDT and other insecticides was implemented. All restaurants and food vendors, as well as all public gathering places, were shut down. Almost all industrial production came to a halt for more than a month. The tourist traffic in India declined by nearly half. Extremely large numbers of people across India, some far away from Surat, self-medicated with tetracycline, often in haphazard and dangerous ways. In faraway cities like Bombay and New Delhi, people started wearing masks. As many as 1 million people, a quarter of the Surat population, fled in crowded railway cars. It turned out that there had not actually been a material outbreak of disease. By some accounts, no one was infected with the plague at all. Years later, there would be confirmation, based on laboratory and genetic analysis, of just 18 cases of plague in the city, although they did not appear connected to each other. The response, however, showed that fear of the disease has its own epidemiology, its own spreading dynamics. In the most fascinating epidemics of fear, referred to as mass psychogenic illness or mass sociogenic illness, otherwise healthy people fall ill in a psychological epidemic. These terms are nowadays preferred to the erstwhile epidemic hysteria. In such outbreaks, people can develop physical symptoms that have no physiological basis, driven by anxiety and fear. In the pure anxiety type, people report a variety of symptoms, including abdominal pain, headache, fainting, dizziness, shortness of breath, nausea, and so on. In the motor type, people may engage in hysterical dancing or manifest pseudo-seizures. The 17th century Salem witch trials were triggered by a bout of mass psychogenic illness when a group of Puritan girls fell ill with fits and laid the blame for their apparent possession on a number of local women. Historical records of such phenomena date back to at least 1374, when, in close succession to the Black Death, dancing manias broke out, initially in Aachen, Germany. These consisted of people who, united by one common delusion, exhibited to the public, both in the streets and in the churches, the following strange spectacle. They formed circles hand in hand and appeared to have lost all control over their senses, continued dancing, regardless of the bystanders, for hours together in wild delirium until at length they fell to the ground in a state of exhaustion. They then complained of extreme oppression and groaned as if in the agonies of death. In those days, symptoms were often blamed on demons and witchcraft, but in modern times, the trigger is usually identified as some kind of environmental contamination. Usually, such outbreaks occur in schools or occupational settings. Perhaps this explains the Surat diamond cutters, where people are in close contact. For instance, an outbreak occurred in 1998 at the Warren County High School in McMinnville, Tennessee. The school had 1,825 students and 140 staff members. One day, a teacher believed she smelled gasoline, and she complained of headache, shortness of breath, dizziness, and nausea. Some of her students soon developed similar symptoms. As the classroom was being evacuated, other students, witnessing the evacuation, began to report the same complaints. A school-wide fire alarm was activated, and the school was emptied. The original teacher and several students were transported by ambulance to a nearby hospital in full view of other students and teachers who were outside because of the alarm. In the end, 100 people went to the hospital that day, and 38 were admitted. The school was closed. Extensive examination of possible environmental causes for the illness was conducted by the CDC. No physical sources were identified, despite much testing and evaluation. The investigators concluded that psychogenic factors were responsible. They found that the illness was associated with directly observing another ill person during the outbreak in a contagious process. Similar examples occur roughly every 2 years or so somewhere in the United States. Other sorts of emotional reactions may foster other normative contagions. For example, when people flouted rules of mask wearing or physical distancing in parts of the United States in May 2020, they reinforced one another's perceptions of safety and control in a way that was counterproductive to their own interests and to those of our society. The large parties I saw in photographs taken in Missouri, Michigan, and Florida in June 2020 reminded me of a miniature version of the dancing manias seen long ago. As noted earlier, in the case of the possible parallel epidemic of a virus and of fear, there can be both biological and social contagions. People generally copy the visible behaviors of those around them, so there can be tipping points in both directions. As more and more people start to wear masks and obey rules of physical distancing, more people follow suit. Conversely, as more and more people ignore these practices, fewer people take them seriously. As psychologist Matthew Lieberman put it, our brains are built to ensure that we will come to hold the beliefs and values of those around us. Truth is another casualty of plague. Some of the most damaging and self-injurious responses to an epidemic are denial and lies. Deadly epidemics always drag along these sidekicks. Unfortunately, modern media technologies provide a bonanza of disinformation, the sort of thing that charlatans of earlier epochs could only dream of. In the case of coronavirus, the pandemic began with one particularly big lie that originated in China right at the start and lasted through the middle of January, the suppression of information about what was happening in Wuhan. This is part of the reason that, for many millions of Chinese, Dr. Li became a symbol of the desire for free and honest expression. Before he died of COVID-19, Li himself told a Chinese magazine from his hospital bed, "I think there should be more than one voice in a healthy society, and I don't approve of using public power for excessive interference." In March, something similar began to happen in hospitals around the United States. In Bellingham, Washington, not far from Seattle, during the peak of the outbreak, Dr. Ming Lin was terminated after 17 years of working at Peace Health St. Joseph Medical Center because he posted pleas for personal protective equipment on Facebook and decried the fact that the hospital was not serious enough about protecting patients and healthcare workers. Dr. Lin, who had previously worked in New York City during the 9/11 attacks, expressed his wholly appropriate concern about the hospital refusing to screen all patients for the virus outside of the facility before bringing them inside the crowded emergency department, which might contribute to the spread of the infection. When I first heard about this case, I marveled at the chutzpah and absurdity of firing a doctor for speaking out in the middle of an epidemic when he was actually needed most. One orthopedic surgeon working in an urban COVID-19 hotspot in the Northeast reported, "We get a daily warning about being very prudent about posts on personal accounts. They've talked about this with respect to various issues, case numbers, case severity, testing availability, and PPEs." An attending physician at a hospital in Indiana posted a plea on social media for N95 masks. Administrators warned him not to do it again, because it could make the hospital seem incompetent. In Chicago, Lori Mazurkiewicz, a nurse at Northwestern Memorial Hospital, was fired after sending an email to her colleagues expressing the desire to wear more PPE on duty. One of her concerns was that she might bring the virus back to her 75-year-old father, who suffered from respiratory disease. There were far too many such incidents in the United States in the spring of 2020. Hospitals around the country issued ham-fisted edicts trying to stop personnel from speaking out. At the New York University Langone Health System in New York City, the Executive Vice President for Communications and Marketing informed the faculty and staff that all media inquiries had to be directed to her office. She continued, "Anyone who does not adhere to this policy or who speaks or disseminates information to the media without explicit permission of the Office of Communications and Marketing will be subject to disciplinary action, including termination." To put it mildly, the professors of medicine who worked in this hospital did not appreciate this note, as some of them informed me. Over the past 30 years, there has been a steady shift from seeing doctors as independent professionals to seeing them as mere employees of large organizations that are often led by people who have little appreciation for clinical care. The pandemic brought this tension into sharp relief. A family doctor in Massachusetts observed, "There's been a loss of autonomy and a denigration going on for a couple of decades now, and the coronavirus epidemic is causing it to erupt." Around the country, administrators who should have been finding ways to improve the efficiency of their hospitals or obtain the equipment that physicians and nurses needed to care for patients were instead trying to manage the epidemic by censoring or suppressing bad news. The muzzling of doctors also took place at the highest levels of our government. President Trump sidelined and nearly fired Dr. Nancy Messonnier, a CDC official who was the director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, because during a press conference on February 25, 2020, she honestly noted that the CDC was preparing for a pandemic. She said, "It's not a question of if this will happen, but when this will happen, and how many people in this country will have severe illnesses." The president did not like the fact that her statement resulted in a slight decline in the stock market, as if keeping quiet about the impending pandemic would prevent either the disease or the economic losses it would inevitably cause. In fact, one of the great travesties of the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States has been the undermining and muzzling of the widely respected CDC. On that same day, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar absurdly claimed the virus was contained in the United States. But we cannot beat the virus with silence or with lies. Only truth and a megaphone help in such fights. In another example, on May 22, 2020, the CDC posted updated recommendations urging religious communities to consider suspending or at least decreasing the use of choir, musical ensembles, and congregants singing, chanting, or reciting during services or other programming, if appropriate within the faith tradition. Since SARS-2 was known to spread by these means, such guidance was factual and potentially life-saving. The White House demanded this information be removed. As in China earlier, the flow of epidemiological information needed political approval. In a specious misdirection, the White House insisted on adding language that the guidance is not intended to infringe on rights protected by the First Amendment. Yet, like any building with large groups assembled, churches could be venues for the spread of disease, and several outbreaks at churches had already proven deadly. In any case, as the Supreme Court noted at the same time, in a different case involving California churches, the key issue was whether secular and religious organizations were being treated differently by the state during a public health emergency. Providing information about the risk posed by singing or large gatherings with regard to contagious respiratory disease, even if the specific example is churches, could not be unconstitutional. These types of restrictions on the flow of information are often justified on the grounds that they reduce panic or foster consistency, but they so frequently result in harmful effects that it's hard to give those explanations any credence. None of this was new, of course. Federal scientists have been silenced for politically inconvenient expression of basic scientific facts during epidemics before. During the HIV epidemic in 1987, Surgeon General Everett Koop, who had been chosen by President Reagan for his opposition to abortion, surprised many in conservative and liberal circles alike by urging explicit language to describe HIV risks, including discussions of anal sex and condom use. As Koop argued, "People criticize me because they see homosexuals or drug abusers or promiscuous people as being sort of beyond the pale, and AIDS is no more than they deserve. My answer to that is that I am the Surgeon General of the heterosexuals and the homosexuals, of the young and the old, of the moral or the immoral, the married and the unmarried. I don't have the luxury of deciding which side I want to be on. So I can tell you how to keep yourself alive no matter what you are. That's my job." But Koop was overruled by the Secretary of Education, William J. Bennett, who proceeded to inject ideological considerations into this public health topic. Bennett insisted that AIDS education materials be values-based and not involve morally ambiguous materials. As a consequence of Bennett's intervention, the government materials became epidemiologically vague and even misleading. Yet, since there were no treatments or vaccinations to prevent the disease back then, public education and public health interventions were indeed the only tools we had available. Forms of transmission reduction, for example, condom use, or contact reduction, for example, reducing the number of sexual partners, were required. President Reagan was not able to bring himself to mention the epidemic until 6 years into his administration, again, as if not mentioning an epidemic can somehow make it disappear. Similar dynamics, psychologically and politically, have played out with SARS-2. It was not just average Americans who engaged in wishful thinking that the virus was no worse than the flu or that it would simply disappear on its own. Even the President of the United States, with the best epidemiologists and intelligence apparatus in the world available to him, engaged in deep and public denial. "Nobody would have ever thought a thing like this could have happened," the president insisted, as he falsely accused the former administration of not making pandemic preparation plans while he himself had disbanded the epidemic response team in 2018. We know from subsequent leaks that the president was indeed presented with information about the seriousness of the virus and its pandemic potential beginning at least in early January 2020. And yet, as documented by the Washington Post, he repeatedly stated that it would go away. On February 10th, when there were 12 known cases, he said he thought the virus would go away by April with the heat. On February 25th, when there were 53 known cases, he said, "I think that's a problem that's going to go away." On February 27th, when there were 60 cases, he said famously, "We have done an incredible job. We're going to continue. It's going to disappear. One day, it's like a miracle. It will disappear." On March 6th, when there were 278 cases and 14 deaths, again he said, "It'll go away." On March 10th, when there were 959 cases and 28 deaths, he said, "We're prepared, and we're doing a great job with it, and it will go away. Just stay calm. It will go away." On March 12th, with 1,663 cases and 40 deaths recorded, he said, "It's going to go away." On March 30th, with 161,807 cases and 2,978 deaths, he was still saying, "It will go away. You know it. You know it is going away, and it will go away, and we're going to have a great victory." On April 3rd, with 275,586 cases and 7,087 deaths, he said again, "It is going to go away." He continued, repeating himself, "It is going away. I said it's going away, and it is going away." In remarks on June 23rd, when the United States had 126,060 deaths and roughly 2.5 million cases, he said, "We did so well before the plague, and we're doing so well after the plague, it's going away." Such statements continued as both the cases and the deaths kept rising. Neither the virus nor Trump's statements went away. In addition to denying the threat of the virus, Trump promoted misinformation about other essential responses to the crisis. On March 2, 2020, Trump claimed that a vaccine would be ready over the next few months, although in reality, the timeline would be considerably longer. On March 6th, Trump falsely insisted that anyone who wants a test can get a test, despite widespread frustration among doctors and patients regarding the manifestly insufficient supply of such tests. He repeated such statements often, noting the beautiful and abundant testing and boasting about American superiority while failing to compare testing rates in other countries on a per capita basis. What accounts for these departures from reality, and why do they fail to elicit outrage or even argument in so many people? In part, the president was playing to the desires of large numbers of Americans to simply wish the calamity away. But in addition, the denial of the reality of the COVID-19 pandemic is the latest manifestation of a fissure between science and politics that has been widening for decades in the United States, especially when scientific consensus has implications that are inconvenient to policymakers, as we will discuss in Chapter 7. But the timeline of a pandemic is much more rapid than that of other public controversies about science, like climate change, meaning that the reality of this situation and the consequences of political acts that are divorced from scientific reality present themselves much more immediately for all to see. In location after location around the country and around the world, people seem shocked that the virus could devastate their population and flood their hospitals with patients, even though the virus had done this exact thing in other places just a few weeks before. Houston, whose hospitals were inundated in June, seemed to have expected a different fate than New York City, whose hospitals were deluged in March, just as New York City had thought it was different from Wuhan, which was overrun in February. This denial was itself a very dangerous aspect of the COVID-19 pandemic. But denial is an old ally of pathogens. Here is an observation by a physician during the Great Plague of Marseille in 1720, which was the last major outbreak of bubonic plague in Western Europe. Already the public, prone to delude themselves and easy to believe what they wished to be true, attributed the malady of these persons to anything rather than to the plague, and began even to joke upon their own alarms. But the subtle destroyer, mocking alike the precautions of the wise and the jokes of the incredulous, was secretly insinuating itself far and wide. All this is very human. And just as we saw that fear might offer some upside to pandemic response, I suppose denial might also offer some advantages, for instance, by allowing people to go about their lives despite the threat. A similar sort of wishful thinking emerged during the profound protests after the brutal murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis on May 25, 2020. The 46-year-old black man was already handcuffed and on the ground when a police officer knelt on his neck until he died. This, coming on the heels of many similar cases, led to massive protests erupting around the nation. In large part, these were due to pent-up anger about racial inequality, but the high levels of unemployment, the long periods people had been cooped up at home, the emotionally demanding experiences, including deaths of loved ones that many people had suffered, and the disillusionment with the president all surely facilitated the protests. The protesters seemed to represent a broad swath of Americans across ethnic and racial lines, judging from the video footage. But many experts who had previously opined that schools had to close and that even small funerals were dangerous now seemed willing to overlook the risks of mass gatherings for a just cause they supported politically. To be fair, most of the protesters wore masks, and the protests were outdoors, which is much less risky. But the public health messaging was inconsistent. At roughly the same time, despite rapidly rising case counts, various governors reopened their states. In Tennessee in early June, the governor loosened restrictions, allowing fairs and parades. Thanks to the continued hard work of Tennesseans and business owners operating responsibly, we're able to further reopen our state's economy, Governor Bill Lee intoned optimistically. But the virus does not care whether our reason for assembling is a protest, a funeral, or a parade. There are many people, and not just those in positions of power, who have persuaded themselves that reality is socially constructed, that there is no objective reality, there is only that which we define using human faculties. This is a deeply interesting philosophical idea. But this has also led to the belief that we can change reality by manipulating words or images. If we call something by a different name, it actually is different. This is only partly true in a narrow sense. The virus is real, and it does not care how we see it or what we say about it. Throughout the pandemic, from the beginning when political figures across the world and across the United States thought it could be denied or wished away by positive statements, to right and left-wing protests in the spring and summer of 2020 that seemed to reflect the belief that the virus was gone or would not affect people too much as long as their cause was just, this sort of thinking prevailed. But reality matters. One analysis estimates that if control measures such as physical distancing had been implemented just 1 week earlier in the United States, the nation would have seen 61.6% fewer reported infections and 55.0% fewer reported deaths by May 3, 2020. Although responsibility for the pandemic cannot be placed solely on the shoulders of any single person, group, or institution, and the United States was not the only country to downplay early warning signs of the virus, one of the great tragedies of the COVID-19 pandemic is that some of the worst outcomes could have been avoided had our predicament been acknowledged and acted upon at the appropriate time. Misinformation has been everywhere during the COVID-19 pandemic. A survey of 8,914 people released on March 18, 2020, revealed that 29% of Americans believed that SARS-2 was developed in a Chinese laboratory in Wuhan. The Wuhan Institute of Virology, a high-security, biosafety level 4, BSL-4 laboratory for conducting research on the deadliest pathogens, is, in fact, located there. This lab was initially established in the 1950s, and it was relaunched with fanfare as a BSL-4 lab in 2017, with the many precautions typical of such facilities. And it is true that at the time of the relaunching, some scientists outside China worried about pathogens escaping and the addition of a biological dimension to geopolitical tensions between China and other nations. But the conspiracy theory that SARS-2 was deliberately genetically engineered appeared almost immediately after the virus did in January 2020. By late February, some commentators were supporting the theory based in part on public statements made by the Chinese government about improving safety precautions at microbiology labs. The argument was this: why would the Chinese authorities want to increase safety if SARS-2 had not escaped from a lab? But why, I wondered, would they announce such changes if SARS-2 had actually escaped? In February, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas publicly spread this theory about the origins of the virus. President Trump did it well into May 2020, despite the fact that the American intelligence agencies themselves, along with knowledgeable geneticists, had concluded that the virus was not genetically engineered. There is indeed much that argues against this conspiracy theory. Since SARS-2 is especially fatal for the elderly and the chronically ill, it would not make a particularly effective bioweapon. To cause the most havoc, something that targeted young and healthy people would be better. But most persuasively, detailed genetic analyses of the pathogen show a pattern of descent from prior bat coronaviruses and of randomly occurring genetic mutations that are not compatible with deliberate genetic engineering. However, it is very difficult to exclude the possibility of an accidental release of a naturally occurring pathogen that was collected from bats and then taken to the lab for study. But since we know of many examples of zoonotic diseases leaping to humans in the normal course of events, including SARS-1, the balance of probabilities, at least to me and most experts, still leans heavily toward a chance move of a naturally occurring pathogen. Another early dubious theory was that the virus was somehow spread by 5G cell phone towers. This led to the burning and destruction of many such towers in the United Kingdom. After initial discussion of this topic among fringe online networks in the United States, certain American celebrities amplified it, including actor Woody Harrelson. He directed his 2 million followers on Instagram to a video about this theory, though he subsequently deleted the post. British musician MIA also shared her observations about the conspiracy. Later in April, Inetha Lynette Hardaway and her Nitha Rochelle Hardaway Richardson, the social media personalities and former Fox Nation hosts known as Diamond and Silk, also warned their millions of followers of a link between 5G and coronavirus. Not to be outdone, the Chinese government propaganda machine swung into action. A U.S. Army reservist and mother of two, Machi Benassi, had gone to Wuhan to compete in a cycling competition in October 2019 as part of the Military World Games, a kind of Olympics for the armed forces. For unknown reasons, an American conspiracy theorist decided to connect the idea that somehow Benassi had brought the virus to Wuhan to different rumors that the virus was an American plot and that the virus had come from the United States to China rather than the other way around. He proclaimed this to his 100,000 followers on YouTube. Media outlets in China, affiliated with the Chinese Communist Party, were more than happy to promote this newly embellished theory in their own country, generating enormous attention on many Chinese social media sites. The real-life consequences of this lie have been awful for Benassi and her family, who became the target of conspiracy theorists. U.S. Defense Secretary Mike Esper said it was completely ridiculous and irresponsible for the Chinese government to promote this claim, which was ironic considering President Trump's own bogus statements about various aspects of the pandemic. All these types of misinformation multiplied during the pandemic. Indeed, conspiracy theories can resemble pathogens in their capacity to mutate, evolving to fit the landscape in which they survive and spread. And, like the virus, this misinformation can harm us. Misinformation also abounded with respect to supposed cures for the virus. As if on cue, right from the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, hucksters of all varieties appeared to offer nostrums that did not and could not work. Many took advantage of powerful modern media tools that allowed them to reach millions of people. An organization in Florida, calling itself the Genesis 2 Church of Health and Healing, was ordered by a judge to stop selling its sacramental dosing for coronavirus, which consisted of a powerful bleaching agent ordinarily used as an industrial chemical. The organization described its purported elixir as a miracle mineral solution. Media figure Alex Jones, the Sandy Hook massacre denier, who appears to endlessly search for ways to profit from other people's sorrow, also got in on the act. His InfoWars operation, which consists of a blog, audio and video feeds, and an online store, began to market products that contained colloidal silver to treat coronavirus. The substance has no known antiviral effect, though taking too much of it can turn your skin blue. "This stuff kills the whole SARS-CoV family at point-blank range," he said in a live stream on March 10, 2020. An Oklahoma company called Energetics opined that colloidal silver is still the only known antiviral supplement to kill all seven of these human coronaviruses. "This Chinese Wuhan flu pneumonia has a non-traditional remedy that has successfully killed coronaviruses from the flu virus to pandemic diseases in vitro for over 100 years. I have to say that accurately identifying the correct number of coronavirus species known to infect humans was a nice touch in this pitch. Even Jim Baker, another fraudster and televangelist cum convict from the 1980s, got in on the act, selling a similar silver-based product. Many herbal remedy companies, with names like Herbal Amy and Quinescence Aromatherapy, also sprang into action to exploit the opportunity. They, like the purveyors of bleach and silver, got warning letters from the FDA or FTC. California-based Guru Nanda used online social media and its website to make its pitch. "Just what is this new coronavirus and how can you prevent and or treat it?" it asked, before claiming that its frankincense product was a way to decrease your chances of becoming infected. In Los Angeles, an animal rights activist was enjoined by the FTC from illegally selling an herbal supplement that he said could treat coronavirus. That product, sold under the brand name Whole Leaf Organics, allegedly contained 16 hand-selected herbal extract strains that both prevented and treated COVID-19. On Instagram, beauty influencers like Michelle Phan promoted essential oils as a treatment for the disease. On the same medium, wellness guru Amanda Chantal Bacon suggested the use of plant-based alchemy. A pastor in California suggested oil of oregano. There were many others. Sensing the deluge of phony products, the FDA tried to stem the tide by releasing an open letter on March 6, 2020, warning the public. There are currently no vaccines, pills, potions, lotions, lozenges, or other prescription or over-the-counter products available to treat or cure coronavirus disease. But a lie is halfway around the world while the truth is still putting on its shoes. And anyway, Donald Trump once again undermined the government's message. During an astonishing news conference on April 23, 2020, he speculated that bleach administered topically or even internally or via injection could help, and that blasting people with ultraviolet light might cure the disease. The manufacturers of Clorox and Lysol had to issue statements pleading with Americans not to inject or ingest their products, since that could kill them. There was a certain irony in this turn of events, given Lysol's old history of promoting itself as a feminine disinfectant. It was used ineffectively as a contraceptive. Even worse, Trump used his bully pulpit in a more sustained fashion to repeat claims that hydroxychloroquine, an antimalarial agent, could cure or prevent COVID-19. While a series of uncontrolled studies had raised the possibility that this drug might help, many physicians, myself included, were deeply alarmed by this recommendation, not only because the drug can have cardiac toxicity, but also because there's no good evidence for its utility. Trump fervently supported the drug, despite repeated warnings by the scientific community that there was no conclusive evidence regarding its effectiveness. Like the wearing of masks, opinions on the efficacy of hydroxychloroquine became a political litmus test. Chloroquine and its chemical cousin, hydroxychloroquine, have long been used against malaria and also to treat arthritis and lupus. Some papers by Chinese scientists appeared online in February 2020 suggesting the possible utility of these drugs in the care of COVID-19 patients. But the connection between hydroxychloroquine and COVID-19 really got going on March 11, 2020, when a small group of investors and a philosopher discussed it as a potential cure for the virus in a Twitter thread. They released a paper on Google Docs, since deleted, suggesting that the drug could both treat and prevent COVID-19, falsely affiliating multiple universities and the National Academy of Sciences with the paper. Soon, they were invited on two different Fox News shows. Hours after their Fox News appearance, on March 21, 2020, Trump tweeted that the combination of hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, an antibiotic, might be one of the biggest game changers in the history of medicine. He announced from the White House podium the following day that the promising drug, hydroxychloroquine, had been approved for immediate use, which was not actually true. At the same late March briefing, Trump's own coronavirus task force members, including Dr. Fauci, were hesitant to promote the drug. The FDA did approve it for emergency use on March 29th, stipulating that it should be given only to hospitalized COVID-19 patients when participation in a clinical trial was not an option. Unfortunately, the president's rhetoric had more impact initially than scientific publications. One large and representative national survey conducted at the end of April 2020 found that 40% of respondents indicated that they obtained information from his briefings in the preceding 24 hours, which compared favorably to outlets like CNN, 37%, Fox News, 37%, and MSNBC, 19%. Between March 23rd and March 25th alone, Fox News promoted hydroxychloroquine 146 times. On March 22nd, a couple in Arizona drank fish tank cleaner after seeing that it contained chloroquine phosphate, which is not the pharmaceutical form of chloroquine, leading to the man's death. His wife recalled thinking, "Hey, isn't that the stuff they're talking about on TV?" From April to May, the scientific community and the FDA released numerous reports warning the public about hydroxychloroquine's harmful, even fatal effects. On April 24th, the FDA issued a safety warning since the drug can result in dangerous heart rhythms. Medical journals also published papers warning about the same negative effects. These cardiac side effects can be particularly deadly for severely afflicted COVID-19 patients who often are older or have heart disease. Small initial studies using the drug in humans began to emerge with inconclusive outcomes or with an indication that the drugs could be harmful due to cardiac toxicity. Several larger observational studies in May and June found no beneficial association between using the drug and a lowered risk of intubation or death, whether the drugs were used early or late in the course of the disease. Subsequently, in early June 2020, a high-quality randomized trial involving 821 patients showed that the drug did not prevent COVID-19. In July, two other randomized trials, one with 4,716 patients and one with 667 patients, showed it did not help patients who were already sick with the disease either. Nevertheless, on May 18, 2020, hydroxychloroquine made national headlines again when the president championed it in the strongest way possible, announcing that he was taking the drug preventatively. It's unclear why Trump did this, but several members of his White House team had tested positive for the virus in the preceding week. The actions of snake oil salesmen preying on our emotions at every level of society are not without consequences. They waste personal and collective resources. They lead to a broad undermining of science and rationality when we need them most. And they lead to a false sense of security, encouraging risky behavior and therefore the spread of the virus. Superstitions and desperate desires for preventatives and cures have always arisen during times of plague. For example, during the plague of Justinian, John of Ephesus noted, "A rumor from somebody spread among those who had survived that if they threw pitchers from the windows of their upper stories onto the streets and they burst below, death would flee from the city. When foolish women, out of their minds, succumbed to this folly in one neighborhood and threw pitchers out, the rumor spread from this quarter to another and over the whole city, and everybody succumbed to this foolishness, so that for 3 days people could not show themselves on the streets, since those who had escaped death in the plague were assiduously occupied, alone or in groups, in their houses with chasing away death by breaking pitchers." We can see many of the ideas circulating regarding COVID-19 in this light. One survey of a representative sample of Americans conducted in late March 2020 reported that in the preceding week alone, 34% of Americans had seen someone on social media being told that they had shared misinformation regarding COVID-19, and 23% of respondents reported that they themselves had felt compelled to correct someone online. An even higher percentage, 68%, endorsed the idea that people should respond when they see others sharing falsehoods. An extensive analysis of Twitter data from January 16, 2020 to March 15, 2020, revealed that the sharing of sites full of misinformation was almost as common as the sharing of links to credible sites like the CDC. Online discussions of 5 specific myths increased noticeably in early March, including the efficacy of home remedies like eating garlic, drinking ginger tea, drinking silver, or sipping water, and conspiracy theories about the virus being an engineered bioweapon designed by the Chinese government, the U.S. government, the liberal media, or Bill Gates. Another analysis of 200 million tweets about the pandemic, collected from January through May 2020, found that 62% of the top 1,000 retweeters were bots. There were more than 100 different types of inaccurate information, including about quack cures, but the bots really weighed in on online conversations regarding ending stay-at-home orders and reopening America. The researchers concluded that the bot activity seemed orchestrated, possibly by agents of the Russian or Chinese governments, and many of the tweets promoted by the bots referred to conspiracy theories such as the ones about coronavirus being linked to 5G cell phone towers. There is increasing evidence that the Chinese and Russian governments have a long-standing and ongoing program in place to undermine Americans' confidence in science and scientists. And formal analyses of a network of interactions among 100 million people on Facebook show that users spreading falsehoods, for instance, about the risks of vaccination, are often better able to occupy positions of structural power in the network, dominating the conversation and increasingly winning out against true information. The circulation of truth and lies during the coronavirus pandemic was also heightened inadvertently by the increasing use by scientists of a new tool for communication known as preprint servers that in some ways contributed to the confusion. For over 60 years, the method employed to get a journal article published has been the same. Researchers submit their papers to journals. The editors of those journals circulate the papers anonymously to the researchers' peers, and those scientists attempt to find flaws in the papers or make suggestions for improvement. The paper's authors then respond to these criticisms, a process that usually involves multiple rounds of review and substantial delays, and the paper is published, or more often, rejected. Peer review is not a guarantee of accuracy, but, like the jury system for criminal justice, it is, as some of my colleagues joke, the worst system we have except for any other. But beginning in the early 1990s, some scientists started releasing their papers prior to the peer review process on preprint servers. This allows their peers a broad opportunity to comment on papers before they are sent out for formal review. There are many such servers and systems, among them Archive, BioArchive, MedArchive, SocArchive, SciArchive, SSRN, and NBER. Since the systems are generally open to everyone, not just scientists, journalists and ordinary citizens have increasingly been accessing this information. On the one hand, pre-publication access increases the speed of dissemination of useful information and facilitates the widest possible effort to weed out inaccuracies. On the other hand, the information may be false or incomplete or, at a minimum, not carefully vetted. Even robust studies are improved significantly by undergoing peer review, and non-experts usually lack the skills to evaluate its scientific validity. During the coronavirus pandemic, therefore, preprint servers contributed to the dissemination of true information, but also to what the WHO called an infodemic of false information. Online platforms like Twitter and Medium also fed this phenomenon. Many scientists weeded out bad ideas and had productive conversations online. But we also saw the wide dissemination of falsehoods and crackpot ideas that could adversely affect both health policy and clinical care. For example, early on, many dramatic estimates of the R-naught for SARS-2 caught the public's attention. Although most likely the true value of this parameter lies in the neighborhood of 3.0, significantly higher estimates, as high as 7.0, appeared in late January. They were widely circulated and caused tremendous and, as it turned out, false alarm. The truth of this pathogen was bad enough, without exaggeration of preliminary information making things worse. Another glaring example was an erroneous preprint that claimed that the coronavirus, impossibly, had insertions of genetic material from HIV. By the time scientists had debunked this study, prompting its wholesale withdrawal, it had entered into wide circulation on Twitter and even in the mainstream media. The epidemics of emotions and of misinformation intersect in worrisome ways with the underlying epidemic of the pathogen itself. And this in turn highlights once again the crucial role of public education during the time of a pandemic. Even though the science might be tenuous, and findings can change given new observations, officials can and should be both sensitive and honest. It's of course acceptable for officials to change their minds and update or even reverse prior advice. But we can reduce cynicism and strengthen collective will if the reasons for such changes are offered and the strength of the evidence and the degree of uncertainty is communicated whenever information is shared. Given what the virus did to us and what we did to ourselves in response, we had many reasons for despair. And in addition to these twin biological and social shocks, we also face the problem of uncertainty about the nature of the challenges before us. Our adversity elicited psychological responses that are common to our species. We felt sadness and grief, responded with anxiety, fear, and anger, and tried to hide the truth from one another and even from ourselves. These emotional responses and behaviors can themselves rightly be seen as foundational parts of epidemics. We might even say that the definition of an epidemic disease should include the fact that it can have outsized psychological effects. And the public health response to epidemics must be driven not only by the medical, social, and economic aspects of the threat, but also by the psychological dimensions. To cope with a plague in the 21st century, we responded not only with familiar interventions, but also with familiar feelings.